Okay, Bob and Cameron McCune are back together, and this is our 28th episode, and we're finishing up our review of the end of my book on Donald Trump and the tech body, and we're reading the last part of the tech body dialogue with anybody, who is actually me. And this transcript is based on an actual recording. If anybody's interested, they can hear the recording of it. And we only got to 45 minutes last week, and then there was a disconnect. So, but fortunately, we almost finished our commentary on the end of the dialogue with the tech body. So we're going to do the last short bit and then try to recall some of the things we said. If you're really dedicated, and you should be, if you want to know stuff, you could listen to our recording, and there's another hour or so where it picks up me in the background and you can't hear Cameron, but things I say might, if you know Cameron's work, you might know what Cameron would say. But there's a lot of different things that we mentioned in passing, maybe tending toward gossip, that are interesting. And my part of it you can make out pretty well. So you can hear my contributions. So that's probably all. We could have re-listened to it, but I didn't have the patience and figured out what Cameron said. You didn't re-listen to it all, did you?
No.
Yeah. Whatever it was, a lot of it was stuff I've said before in different times, so the stuff may come up again, the anecdote part.
But Bob, I just noticed something that's quite funny and quite amazing. You said after 45, the recording gets dropped, and that's accurate. That is exactly the case. But in the second last paragraph, the...
Oh, yeah, undo 45. Holy shit.
Isn't that amazing?
And yeah, so the tech body took us literally. Yes, people, we dropped off at 45 minutes. And that's what... talking about Trump and the tech body was discussing, we're going to go over that paragraph again, is discussing the people who were pissed off at Trump being elected were yelling, undo 45. Wow. And that's, we didn't, but you know, did that get said on the recording? I think we did.
I think we were just at that point.
Yeah.
We were discussing that paragraph and its implications. And the book was written a couple of years ago, I believe. So what we have is a kind of feed forward. That's I.A. Richards' word that McLuhan liked. We have a feed forward from when you read this book to our discussion of it last week, and the undo 45 and the need for a redo got relived in our conversation.
Yeah, that's amazing. Okay, yep. So when you go back to around the 38-minute mark, you'll hear us discussing the last week's. You'll hear us discussing the last bit that got recorded properly, and then we digress a little about Captain Beefheart. But the last line that was discussed in good clarity was the tech body says, the power that flew itself was always there. People were starting from Pong. Pong would be the early 70s, that game, digital game. So then the tech body says, and the digital body is getting the pan shot to show how it's all set up. And I put digital body in quotes. The tech body never told me to put it in quotes, but I'm referring to my category of the chip body. But the tech body is saying digital body. So tech body says, and the digital body is getting the pan shot in quotes, to show how it's all set up. So the digital body outdoes what they're trying to use the Android meme to predict, present in a stage. Yes, here's a perfect example. It can move so seamlessly that there's no way in hell Donald J. Trump is ever going to be elected the sitting president of the United States of America. And this conversation was recorded in October 2020, so just before Trump got defeated. As a matter of fact, he or Trump was never truly elected to be president of the United States of America. So we need to rewrite. We need to redo. Undo, blah, blah, blah. Undo, blah, blah, blah. I'm not saying it again. So he names the date, the number of president that Trump is. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to go back and discuss this, but I'll just finish up here. Here we go. They're setting a stage. Now, they're not smart. The holograph told somebody through numbers that were created through the digital body, quote, you're in trouble. So Joe Biden, here are the words that you should say. So the tech body is saying, somebody is telling Joe Biden to say, okay, folks, the only way Donald J. Trump could ever be elected president is from chicanery. By any event, from Bessel Goodman's, I wouldn't take nothing from my journey now, all the way into You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet with Bachman Turner Overdrive. Now, that's interesting. I don't know if we discussed this. There was about the chicanery. There's a charge. Trump makes the charge, still doing it, that it was an election fraud. And he has Biden saying the only way Trump could ever be elected is from chicanery. But that's what Hillary said back in 2016. Mm-hmm. But Biden's guilty. He did the chicanery in 2020.
Biden couldn't do it. It was done by other folks. And
yeah.
He's just the puppet that is put into power through it.
Yes.
When we discussed it last time, we noted that there should have been quotes after chicanery so that the tech body of Trump are not going on to talk about Vestal Goodman and Bachman Turner Overdrive.
Well, the tech body's saying that. No, tech body quotes those songs all the time.
Okay, but remember that when you put...
Yes, right. It's a quote for Biden to say, and yes, he does not say, by any event, it's not even a proper sentence. That's right.
Right. It should be a new paragraph. Started off with point, or something like that.
Maybe I should get Clinton to fix that. Okay. Okay, there's we're almost finished.
Let me just mention a couple things, Bob.
Yeah.
You say digital body is in quotes, but the tech body didn't sort of indicate that. You did. But remember, the tech body probably, if it's not Ian or not you or not whatever, the tech body is speaking here. So when he says the digital body, he's not necessarily speaking about himself.
No.
Right? So the quotes around digital body are accurate.
Okay. Yeah, because the digital body is, in my terms, my five-body scheme is the chip body, and that's the Android meme, which the tech body correctly separates from himself. He says the digital body outdoes what they're trying to use the Android meme to predict. That's a statement. It goes past the Android meme, but there's two phases of the Android meme in my essay. So the tech body is, yes, talking about using the Android meme somehow, being exploited by the chip body. So that's the content of the chip body, the Android meme.
Can the Android meme be used, or isn't it by definition the user?
Well, that's the dilemma. The tech body, or Ian, just told me the other day, he starts off in my private session, and that's usually with Ion, though sometimes the tech body sneaks in, and Ion says, you've overcome the android, you've overcome the five bodies, maybe something else. And then he says, but you can't pass the android meme. And I agree with that. That's how I present the android meme. It's the beginning of technology taking off on its own, and
right.
we're stuck with it, and we got to figure out how to relate to it. And so with that in mind, you can't beat the android meme. So the tech body says the digital body is getting the pan shot to show how it's all set up. So the digital body outdoes what they're trying to use the android meme to predict. See, they're trying to. They're not going to be really able to control the android meme, maybe, or to present on a stage or in a stage. Yes, here's a perfect example. So the digital body wants to make Trump president. Here's a perfect example. It can move so seamlessly that there's no way in hell Donald J. Trump is ever going to be elected the sitting president of the United States of America. As a matter of fact, he was never truly elected to be president of the United States of America. If I got that right, it can move so that there's no way in hell. A perfect example. The tech wise is you can't, or the, and the, who's saying that? Yes, here's a perfect example. It can move so seamlessly. There's no way in hell Trump is going to be elected. He's saying the digital body wants to outdo it. Okay, so the digital body is trying to elect Trump, and the tech body is saying you can't do it. You can't exploit the android meme. But the irony is that Trump does get elected. So, yes, it's hard to figure out what the tech body is saying here, what their position is.
Well, I mean... throughout the book, there's always this interplay of voices. So,
yeah.
so that interplay is not new here. What I think is important is to notice the word seamlessly, which relates to conflation. And so you have thought like Hillary apparently had in 2016, that if a certain map were followed, then there was no way in hell Donald J. Trump is ever going to be elected. So it's that sentence goes back to 2016, and then the next sentence says that takes the fact into consideration that he did get elected despite that seamlessness. And therefore, he was never, ever truly elected.
Right. And you were pointing out last week that seamlessly is Gutenbergian. That's
absolutely
your conflation meaning.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Here's what's interesting. Ion said once Trump... Ion was predicting before the 2020 election that this would lead to a civil war and then a constitutional convention, and Trump would be the viceroy of the new structure, which
yeah.
would be feudalistic. That was
you
generally...
know, Bob, what you know what the word "roy" means?
No, viceroy. No.
Yeah, yeah. It's the French for king, right?
Oh yeah, yeah,
roy.
Yeah. Vice king,
yeah.
Vice president,
yeah.
kind of thing. He's not the king, but he's second king in the British system.
Right,
King
but
of India.
You have to think of the Viceroy of India, for example, is really the executive head of all of India.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's interesting is that in general, I am predicted that Trump would win, be reelected, and they said it would be 49-1. Okay, we accepted that. And I remember him saying the one that wouldn't elect him would be Hawaii, and where I'm living. But it's a very big welfare state. ratio-wise. So the Thursday before the election, I have it in a private session, I ask, redo the question. So is Trump going to win the election? No. Is Biden going to win the election? No. So I go, well, who's going to be elected? Or maybe I said, who's going to win the election? And they say, what election? And it's left there. I didn't pursue it. And that was an odd statement by Ion. But Ion had been making fun of how Biden had not been campaigning properly. So I might have taken it that way, that there was something odd about the election. But then the election happened, and very quickly protests and Sidney Powell got in the news and said there was rigging, and other people presented evidence. So I now say that the most perceptive statement of 2020 was Ion's statement. Neither got elected, and it wasn't a real election because of the rigging. And there's a whole half America believes it was rigged on the Republican side. And it's even increasing. And Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy, he is moving forward. The judge accepted what he had presented so far, so he's still pushing his case through. And Sidney Powell is doing well. The Arizona audit, they haven't been stopped. So we'll see where that goes. But then people said, well, Ion screwed up. He predicted that Biden would win. And they said, 49-1. So either
Trump would win. Trump would win.
Yeah, Trump would win. And so I either asked in a private session or on the show, and Trump, Ion's answer was, we didn't say electoral votes. We said states. And we were referring to the inevitable constitutional convention and how Trump will win that. So that we were all tricked by that. We didn't catch that. We just said, oh, yeah, 49 states to one. That's a Trump landslide. And we thought that's what Ion meant. Now, maybe Ion did mean that, but they had a great cover story to say, or alibi that, oh, no, we're just talking about the constitutional convention. So depending on your alignment with Ion or accepting what Ion does, you're cynical about it or not. But anyways, it was a great cover. But he did say, and it's, he's talking a year before what was going to happen. And then every now and then, every few months, give an update. And it seemed to be generally because of the 49-1 that Trump would win. But then he did say right before the election that Trump would lose. And I would have played that on the Saturday, and then don't know if anybody noticed. No one ever brought it up after the election, but then I brought it up, and then people had to deal with it. So taking all that, so then recently Ion said that Trump, Ion has always said for years that Obama was the last president of the United States, and we can see that. He was the typical proper president. Trump was something different. And so Ion says Trump was actually viceroy in 2016 to 2020, and he, as viceroy, he mocked the legislature, the judiciary, and the presidency itself. So it goes into a few details about the legislature was made to look like a fool. The Republicans were made to be a fool. They were controlled by the crazy Trump. And I don't know what he did with the Supreme Court. I don't know if he wrecked that, though it is wrecked now for those that think Trump was cheated. They don't like the Supreme Court not taking it seriously, the charge that Trump actually was subject to a fraudulent election. So it's a stretch, but Ein says he was mocking the whole thing, and on a certain level he was. And that's part of the reason why so many people hated Trump. He was besmirching the institutions of Washington. Okay, so in light of that, the tech wise says, here's a perfect example. It can move so seamlessly that there's no way in hell Donald J. Trump is ever going to be elected the sitting president of the United States of America. But that's about 2016, which has happened, and he did. As a matter of fact, he was never truly, now look at that, he was never truly elected to be President of the United States of America. There's Ion in October 2020 anticipating what he says in 2021, that he was never president, he was viceroy. So later developments, you can read that differently. Then he says, so we need to rewrite, we need to redo. That is what, I'm not sure who the we, who's saying that?
The Democrats.
Yeah. He hasn't said Biden yet.
You have to go back and to the start of the paragraph where he says, trying to use the Android meme. The trying to use what seemed unbeatable lost in 2016.
Yeah.
And so that's the first paragraph, which is the perfect example, right? So then the first sentence of the perfect example. And then the second sentence goes from the
prediction.
Goes from the lack of ability to elect Hillary through the Android meme in 2016. It goes to the reaction to that loss.
Yeah.
And the reaction is, as a matter of fact, he was never truly elected. That is to say that according to the lights governed by the Android meme, he wasn't going to be elected, and when he was elected, he wasn't truly elected.
And Hillary did say that. Hillary said Russia helped Trump become president.
Definitely. Yeah, amongst other things. Yeah, of course.
It can move so soon that there's no way in hell Donald J. Trump is ever going to be elected.
Right.
Hillary and the Android meme are saying that.
Correct.
But then there's the election, and Trump wins, and we know that. And then you have the continuation of the Android meme and Hillary saying no. As a matter of fact, he was never truly elected. So that's a prediction there by Ion. And Ion, or no, the tape is saying we're trying to use the Android to predict, present in a stage. They're just talking about the first part, that he's not going to be elected. But then it jumps and switches without clarity to the fact that Trump won. And then it goes back to Hillary and them demanding to redo the election or cancel it.
Mm-hmm.
Then it goes...
Note that there's a seamlessness between those two sentences.
Yeah.
Right?
There's
no way in hell that he's ever going to win goes seamlessly to the fact that he didn't win.
Yeah, the Android meme claims he didn't win. That's right.
Right.
Yeah. Good
and
point.
So, and in both cases, there's a variation from reality.
Yeah.
The prediction can't really predict, and then because it can't really predict, there was something wrong with reality, and he wasn't elected.
Right. We're trying to use the Android meme, but something beat the Android meme, and then that points to the tech body, which I say goes further than the Android meme.
But how? That's an interesting question. I don't understand that.
Yeah, let's see if we can come to an explanation of that. So so then the last paragraph, the tech body says, here we go. They're setting a stage, which he had said. They're trying to present it in a stage or a theatrical step by step. Now, they're not smart. The holograph told somebody through numbers that were created through the digital body, told somebody, I don't know who somebody is, but maybe Biden, because it addresses Biden. Now, so Biden is running in 2020 when this is being recorded. You're in trouble. So Joe Biden.
You're in trouble is not being spoken to Joe Biden as much as it is to the people who aren't smart.
Right.
And the people who aren't smart are the people that are trying to present something in a stage. They're setting a stage.
Yeah.
And the stage in this sense is not a theatrical stage. It's one stage after another of a process, and that's governed by Gutenberg.
Right. And so then so the hologram or the holograph told the people, you're in trouble.
Right.
So Joe Biden, here are the words that you should say. So, okay, now Biden's got to deal with his election. So he says, Joe Biden, we're assuming that people want Trump back?
I would say it's like people often point out that propaganda always charges other people with what it itself is doing. So Biden says the only way Donald J. Trump could ever be elected president is from chicanery, but the tech body may be saying, so the only way Joe Biden did get elected is from chicanery.
Yeah. So they're setting a stage. Now, they're not smart. The holograph told somebody through numbers, I guess that's ratings, polls, that were great.
It's also the Android meme computational stuff.
Yeah. The holograph told somebody through numbers that were created through the digital body, you're in trouble. So Joe Biden, here are the words that you should say. So Joe's got to explain that Trump can't win, and Joe's is going to appear to be correct. And Trump doesn't win. But then it reverses, and Trump accuses Biden of doing chicanery. So it's a bit confusing. So then you got to have quotes after chicanery, and I've got to correct this and have the last sentence, by any event, from Vestal Goodman to Bachman Turner Overdrive. That has to be separate. That is the tech body stepping away and commenting on it, the situation from its perspective, where...
Yeah, it's just taking distance.
Yeah, taking distance. And it quotes, I wouldn't take nothing from my journey now. That means there's some kind of, everything is gone. And it's a gospel song, and Vestal Goodman is ready to go to heaven or something.
That was, I think, the last song that she did in public. I'm not completely sure of that, but that was sort of her theme song. And when she knew she was dying, I believe it was the last public song. That,
wow, you knew of her?
Actually, Bob, the way that I knew of Vestal Goodman is that years ago, you had a video somewhere of her singing. I don't think it was this, I wouldn't take nothing from my journey, but it was an incredible outburst.
I know what it was. It's a city song. She was competing with the young guy.
That's right.
Yeah, looking for a city. Looking for a city where I'll never die. Yeah, it's a great video.
That's right. So through your video, I got interested in her.
So you found out about her, got her history. Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah, Ian told me about her, or JW did, back when I first met him. And... you know, J.W.'s a Southern gentleman, and he went to church before Ion. He used to sing in church, and his family they knew Vestal Goodman because they were a wealthy family, so it was very important in his youth, Vestal Goodman. So he told me about it, and I watched it back then, 2009 or 10, and I liked her, and I started looking. I said, wow, she's incredible. So I called her and said I liked it. And he couldn't believe that this northern guy liked Vestal Goodman. He was very surprised. And so we've made her a key singer on the show. And but then Ian's got an incredible pop culture knowledge, and they're always using the Bachman Turner Overdrive song. Ain't seen nothing yet. He would say that when Trump won. What does this mean? Trump won 2016. Well, you ain't seen nothing yet. And of course, that happened. So these are two major themes that Ion has always said, and here you have the tech body appropriated for their own perspective. By any event, from all the way from Vesta Goodman to Bachman Turner Overdrive. That's the range of what we're getting here. That this Ion is saying, no, the tech body is saying, we are in charge now. You ain't seen nothing yet. You know what I mean? That's the tech body talking. And
who knows? Who knows?
Well, no, I know. In retrospect, tech body says we put Trump in and we made all this chaos and we're still doing it. And so then you have a couple of articles: Trump TV post-literate American president, and then this guy who thought Trump was influenced by McLuhan when he read the Playboy interview when Trump was young. He has a whole bunch of stuff on in that article. Trump's 2016 victory, no surprise from McLuhanites. Nobody knows who that guy is who wrote all that stuff back in 2017 or so. But he had, he's quite, he, I think, he presented, no, I got that wrong. In 2012, there was a guy out of Montreal who, leading up to the 2011, the centenary, presented all kinds of skits that he made up of McLuhan at the kitchen table dealing with his centenary. Do you remember that? Did you see that?
No, no.
Yeah, and he made up neat skits about how McLuhan was reacting to the centenary events and was quite cynical and was not impressed. So that guy made that stuff up in Montreal. Then someone comes along in 2017, 2018 and writes an essay showing how Trump was McLuhan-esque and influenced by McLuhan. And that's that second article, Trump 2016, Trump's victory, no surprise for McLuhanites. So I just give those for people to see commentary on the Trump thing, using McLuhan. And then these are my final instructions to the reader. So memorize the quote below, which is about the novel Catch-22 from Take Today. I say memorize the two sentences in red below. Have them ready for all conversations about McLuhan, and say it's what McLuhan discovered, the Catch-22 point about the black market. And then I say, make this quote about Catch-22 more famous than the meaning of the message. Because my whole thesis in general is people are McLuhanites who have just the cliche understanding of McLuhan are not going to understand what's happening in the media, the Android meme, and the tech body, and with Trump. So when they had the what was his name? Paolo had a ongoing series of panels in the spring of 2020 during the COVID thing when everybody was locked down at the beginning of it. And so he thought, well, let's just get all the McLuhanites around the world to discuss reality and what's happening. And I found it quite timid, not McLuhan-esque at all. They were reacting emotionally to Trump and the content, a lot of personal projections, no technical observation. Like he says to Pierre Schaeffer, I'm an esoteric observer, no esoteric observation going on by all these McLuhan scholars. That prompted me, we need to update McLuhan. And so I started emphasizing quotes that people don't know to show the range of the medium and what it applied to, and especially the economy. So the quote is, by Marshall McLuhan and Barrington Evatt, Take Today, 1972, page 211. In the novel, Catch-22. So it says, in Catch-22, the figure of the black market and the ground of war merged into a monster presided over by the syndicate. Then in italics, when war and market merge, all money transactions begin to drip blood. Now, in the 60s, if you thought McLuhan was saying that the global village would be a pastoral scene, if you did a little study, you'd find out, no, global villages are not peaceful and pastoral. That's a Gutenberg projection. And if you got that far, then you said, well, what is this? Oh, it's a global theater. And certainly the world got more violent in the 70s, 80s, 90s than the, quote, utopianism around the 60s anticipated. And my point is McClellan did anticipate it. He said in Playboy magazine in December 68, mind your media, men, or you're going to catch a cold environment. And that's in that 67, 68 period of hippie optimism and whatever other optimism was going on. It was dashed the last month of 68, early 69, with Nixon becoming president, and then the bombing of Cambodia, and then the Kent State Massacre. These were baby boomer events. But here's McClellan in 72, but you have to know that he started writing this in 68.
Marshall, started writing this in 1950.
That's right. Yeah. These are statements that McClellan, you didn't find them unless you read closely. He was capable of saying this many years before. He even said 1984 was obsolete. It was further along than Orwell's 84. So this is a quote that you would say in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, if you were really smart, somebody brings up McClellan, you'd say, well, he said that when war and market merge, all money transactions begin to drip blood. You say that to anybody, they're going to go, what? What did you just say? It would be as startling as the medium as the message was in 1963 or so. You know what I mean? They go, what?
Well, it should be. It should be. I don't think it would be. But
right? No, it should be.
You said it would be as startling, but unfortunately, most of these folks can't be startled.
Yeah, that's right. They wouldn't hear it.
Yeah.
and especially a non-academic like myself would not be listened to. But I used to say this on the radio, you know, in the 80s. It's amazing what I did. I was a prophet within McClellan land. I would say this point. And I would do that to explain the increasing feeling in the 80s and 90s that there were conspiracies and murders and assassinations and pretty dirty world happening in America. That later became a big meme with Alex Jones and those people. Me and Bob Marshall were the first to talk this way in radio culture. It was considered underground and fringe because it was a university station, but we became known and articles were written about me. I held up, there's a picture of me and Carol in 1990. I'm holding up Take Today, and Carol is holding up Dope Inc. by Lynn LaRouche, which is all about the drug world getting into regular banking, merging with banking. And so we're showing two aspects, the global theater, and that the bottom up is the global theater effect, and the top down is Dope Inc. Now, LaRouche is a conspiracy view of history. And they were very good journalists, and they had a lot of details, and more and more conspiracies were showing up in the Justice Department busting dope networks around the world. You had the P2 gangs in Italy, and they were probably shot the 30-day Pope. Anyways, it goes on. Marshall was anticipating it with this quote, all money transactions begin to drip blood, or they appear to, when war and market merge. So a great ending, and Cameron recognizes it's a great ending. And what would you like to say about the ending? What do you have to say about it?
Well, I'll just say that the idea of the figure and ground merging into a monster was a recurrent theme of McClellan in the 70s.
Yes.
One of the funnier instances of this was that he tended to see go-go girls in those terms.
Yes.
The go-go girl in her cage was a kind of monster that nobody recognized as such.
Right, and there's a famous footage of him, I think it's the CBC show Telescope, and he's in the disco, and he says, are they going to turn that down? he's supposed to be commenting on the go-go girls behind him, and he doesn't think it's quiet enough. And they don't turn it down, so he's got to keep talking. And what he says, if you remember, do you know Telescope? Do you know what I'm quoting?
I think I may have seen it years ago. I can't remember.
Yeah, so what he says pop music or this environment presses up against you like foam. Now, that's what girls wore back then. They were called falsies. You know, they put foam in their chest to make themselves have bigger tits or sculpting bigger tits. And then you'd dance close and you'd feel the foam or you'd not know it was foam. But he's describing pop culture as tactile and pressing up you up against you like foam. This is what he says. It's a pretty incredible statement. Do you remember that?
Vaguely, but I think it's interesting for all sorts of reasons.
Yes.
Your point about tactility is very good.
And it is proprioceptive, right, pressing up against
you.
Yeah.
But foam isn't just foam rubber. Foam is also insubstantial bubbles.
Right, which is a line he describes about TV in 55 in Radio and TV versus the Absent-Minded. He talks about TV being a spume.
Yeah.
Spume. Yeah, no, that's important, the foam part. Yeah, good point.
Yeah, so the figure and ground merging into a monster is goes back to the conflation point. I think it was on page 183,
yeah.
Which we identified as the essence of Gutenberg. So the Gutenberg galaxy gets eclipsed in one way by electricity starting way back in the early 19th century.
Yeah.
But in another way, it eats electricity and becomes a world monster that is basically threatening not only our survival, but all the poor creatures that depend upon our sanity. what's being talked about here might be seen as people that are tornado followers or something, where you see this huge black maelstrom, if you will, tending towards the unfortunate city. And McLuhan is wondering if there's something we can do about this or not.
Yeah. Are there tornadoes in Manitoba in the prairies?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Regina downtown was largely leveled by a tornado in 1912.
Wow.
And there's still buildings in downtown Regina where you can see where the building was repaired. It wasn't hurt badly enough to just knock down,
yeah,
like many buildings were. And so you can see buildings in Regina that have an old portion and a new portion from the tornado.
And you grew up in Regina, right?
Absolutely. Born in Regina.
Yeah, did you experience tornadoes as a youth?
No.
So they're rare.
Very rare in the prairies. They're mostly in a line extending from sort of Texas to Chicago.
Right.
So that misses, you know, the Dakotas and the prairies.
Right.
But sometimes you have one. But what you do have in Western Canada are very bad hailstorms. And because of the flatness of the landscape, you can see these black clouds of a hailstorm coming towards you, more or less like a prairie fire. And there's nothing you can do. These clouds are absolutely enormous, and they just descend on you with this hail. And all of the unfortunate farmers for miles around just get wiped out for that year.
Wow, and it breaks windows?
Sometimes.
Yeah. But the real problem is it wipes out the crops.
Yes.
Okay. Now, in 74, in one of the co-host Monday Night Seminars, McLuhan hands out his introduction to the Tetrad, which was just starting to be written about in a couple articles in 73 and 74. Nobody really knew about it. They weren't following these obscure journals unless McLuhan told them that they were a student that year. You know, if you were a student, you knew what McLuhan was doing if you were paying attention. He'd tell you. He'd have some of the articles sitting there on the table. So it was a tetrad on the law of etherealization, which I think is a Bucky Fuller phrase, or maybe an Arnold Toynbee.
Sounds like him, yeah.
Yeah, or Toynbee,
yeah,
one of those guys.
Taken from Toynbee.
Yeah, Toynbee, I think, was the guy. So the law of etherealization, and in it he says figure somewhere in the tetrad, which part, I guess in the enhancement, figure becomes ground, which becomes a monster. That's what he said. The merger of figure ground becomes a monster. So that's the first time I heard him talk about monster other than Typhon and the Mechanical Bride, late 40s, early 50s. Actually in 73 is The Exorcist, and that's kind of monstrous. But I hadn't seen the word monster at that point in 74 much. So he pointed out the figure and ground become a monster. And
right.
So it's
but we should note that from the Second World War on, there were monster movies, especially from Japan.
Oh, yeah. I know about that.
Right? So people were fascinated by and went to movies about all of these monsters that might threaten from outer space. Sometimes it was from outer space, and sometimes it was from, past. Where
the ground under the sea, a Rodan would come out of the sea.
Godzilla.
Yeah. and you know who did a lot of playing with that was Zappa. He had songs called King Kong. He named one of his sons, his middle name is Rodan. He named him after the monster. So in 72, McLuhan is talking about inflation and how you move the tiniest thing at the speed of light, it acquires infinite mass. He came up with a practical application, say in sociology or, I don't know, markets, of E equals MC squared. He said you move a dollar at the speed of light, it'll become inflationary, and that's a monster, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So absolutely. That's his practical application of E equals MC squared. Did you know that?
Yeah. What he was constantly trying to do was interest people in focusing on what was going on. Right? And he, the poor man, let's say from the middle 50s until he died, so 25 years, he just tried in this way and that way and this other way to try to get people to focus. And not only did it not happen in his lifetime, it hasn't happened since.
That's right. Now what? Okay, first of all, did you ever see in Take a Day him talk about E equals MC squared in that way? Moving?
No.
I think it may be more said in his op-ed in 74 for the New York Times, media inflation, a media approach to inflation. That's where he talks about the dollar inflating. But you can go back to Take Today, and it's in there if you do a close read. And he and Barry suck it in there, that point. But it's really not really spelled out till 74. So anyways, that image of McLuhan, it's a very strong image in this documentary. Telescope was a afternoon show, probably once a week, by a guy named Fletcher Markle. And he would feature prominent Canadians in that. So they did a really great half hour on McLuhan, and a lot of neat statements by McLuhan in that documentary. But the scene always stuck to me. He's sitting there, and he's sort of leaning into the table towards the camera with the go-go girls, and he's trying to comment, and he says, are they going to turn that down? But that is exactly McLuhan from 55 on. The world is becoming noisier, and McLuhan is being reasonably polite and just trying to get people to listen, but the world is a disco. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And that's the image of what you're saying. He's there talking quietly politely in a disco, and nobody really cares what he's saying. But he's describing what's going on there in the disco and what the implications are.
Right. So,
now, it's interesting. Some people would say, well, his faith, you know, helped him rise above the disappointment of this and that. What do you think? And Marchand's biography says he got depressed in the 70s. I didn't find him that way in the 70s. And Carpenter's essay about McLuhan in the 50s and how fantastic and energized he was, I didn't experience that energized guy in the early 50s that Carpenter did, or late 40s. But to me, McLuhan had more energy than most people in his conversation. It really died.
You didn't know McLuhan until the 70s, right?
Oh, no. I met McLuhan in the early 60s.
I never heard about that. How did that happen?
Well, you have to read my diaries. You never read my diaries, did you?
I don't know if I did or not.
I was assigned by, remember, I was in intelligence, and they were freaked that he was explaining the medium as a message. That was the secret of the elites around the world in the intelligence agencies, especially the older people coming out of the 19th century. They let the 20th century just be noisy and everybody run around and try their political revolutions. They knew it wouldn't work. They knew that the media ruled. And when he started getting known in the 50s, I write about this in one of my essays, I was told to go find out who was this ridiculous professor that was saying this stuff that was real. And when I met McLuhan, I found out eventually he got it from Wyndham Lewis. And then I started to drop in and see him, and as the world was changing, as you go in the late 50s into the 60s, I knew that what I was doing wasn't really relevant anymore. My father told me a lot about this. He worked in the intelligence agency, and he told me, you might want to get out of this. This is not working. And it's exactly what McLuhan said in Take Today. The spy versus spy world was becoming just a world of entertainment and irrelevant. And he has these quotes on the back on the book sleeve of Take Today, which you've probably read, right? They're very important, what he says about the traditional flatfoot world and how obsolete it is. And I was noticing this.
Notice that spy versus spy was a kind of cartoon featured in Mad Magazine, right?
That's what I'm quoting, yeah. And so in the 60s, I started paying closer attention to McLuhan, like not as an assignment, but what he was actually saying, and he won me over. I realized what he was realizing, whatever degree it was, and I made moves to get out of intelligence. It took me a long time, but eventually did. And I would talk to him. I remember I told you last week I talked to McLuhan about this stuff.
But that was in the 70s.
No, that's the 60s, the late 60s. I didn't start coming to McLuhan regularly until 72, and I pretty well came to every Monday night seminar. But I was visiting in the 60s and listening to him more, not coming and telling him what was going on as if I knew something. You know what I mean? Well, I thought I knew something.
Yeah, but it may be that there were different times that you talked to McLuhan, but when we were discussing this before, you were saying, I asked you if you had to make an appointment, to see him, and you said, yeah, you would do that through Mark Stewart.
Yes.
I don't think that she was organizing his life in the 1960s.
Oh, yeah, she started in 63. That she got the job as soon as he got the center in whenever that was, the spring.
So that's before the Coach House.
Yes, that's right. The Coach House doesn't happen until 68.
Long before the Coach House.
Beg your pardon?
Long. It's 5 years before the
Coach
House.
Yeah, I would go to St. Joseph's. I would go to that. Often if he spoke somewheres, I would go to that if I was in town. And then I would speak in those, in the mid-60s, early 60s, I would talk more after the lecture. I'd follow him somewheres or go. He might go have a coffee, and I would sit in with them, with these other guys that were doing serious seminars. The Coach House was a serious seminar operation in the mid-60s. Did you know that? They would have guest lecturers and present stuff. And I've got a lot of the papers of that period that were presented.
You're calling that the Coach House. That's pre-Coach House.
Yeah. Well, you're right. It's in the in St. Joseph. That's right. I shouldn't be calling it the Coach House. But it was in the his office. Very small group. And I think there might have been some places in Carr Hall that he would meet when it got bigger. But remember, he's not a big phenomenon until 67, 68. That's when all of the students are crowding in. And that's at Fordham. And then he comes back, and he's got the Coach House from the fall of 68. And that's the Coach House. That's the crowded thing. And it's crowded till about 75, I'd say. I didn't start going to them regularly until 72, but it turned out I was probably attending the most because they were formal in the 70s, in the 60s. And Barry Nevitt would go to those. And I got reports. They'd write up reports about each thing, each presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen
those? I don't think Barry was there in the early 60s.
No, he showed
I think,
up.
I
know exactly when Barry showed up. He got Understanding Media from his wife at Christmas 64. So he showed up in January 65.
Yeah, I was going to say it was probably 65, yeah.
Yeah, and then he then becomes an insider by 68. And Ralph Baldwin drops the Future of Management project. That was him and McLuhan in 66 and 68. And Barry replaces Baldwin in 68, and they work on Take Today for four years, and it was probably called Future of Management or something, even in the late 60s, early 70s. Remember, in the Life magazine, February 66, they list the books he's working on. And one of the titles is Future of Management, and I think another one's Cliched Archetype. Do you remember that article?
No.
Yeah.
But what you're saying rings true.
Yeah. And it lists several books. And, Cliched Archetype, they started working on that, he and Watson, in 62, 63. That took a long time. I'll have to go look up my reports, see what I've got here. You see, when Derek took over in 83, David Olson was the director, and Derek was the assistant director, and the Coach House finally was accepted by the University of Toronto again, and that starts in early 83. So there was a two-year period, 81 to 83, where Eric and Derek and Logan would organize meetings as much as possible at different places around the campus that they would get permission to be in. So it was a mobile thing for a couple of years. But when Derek got the official position, he started, I guess he... David Olson would bring in official people, and there would be papers written up from Olson's series, and I have copies of those. But Derek did, in between, or he did another day or something, and I would go to them, and they weren't attended by many people, but Derek ran them, and I have copies of his one-pager kind of summaries of that. And so he was second in command for from 83 till about 86. Then Olson quit, and he took over. And then Derek started flying all over the world. It was more of a global outreach. And now me and Nelson and Barry Nevitt started the McLuhan Monday Night Seminars, the informal one, and Derek called us McLuhan Fanfare. And we did that 83 into 84 for about a year. And then that faded out. Nelson got alienated and left. And Barry was around, but he didn't have any allies to feature him. We would feature Barry every week, and me and Nelson. And so then Derek just taught courses, I would say, in 85, 86, 87. So then I got on the radio in 87, so I stopped going to the coach house. I had moved it out into the air. I was on the air, spreading the word, the gospel, and thought I was doing way better than whatever Derek was doing. You know what I mean?
Sure. And how did your radio stint end?
I went 4 years. Well, I got this younger guy, Bob Marshall, to do the journalistic stuff from 84 to 87. And that was May Brussel, Sherman Skolnick, LaRouche's people called Executive Intelligence Review, and Dr. Beter and Walter Bowert. So I got Bob to summarize their weekly tapes and their information, and we presented after 3 years. I was behind the scenes, and then Bob Marshall played a Dr. Beter tape, and Adam Vaughn, he objected. You don't know the Toronto scene, right? You don't know who Colin Vaughn is.
No.
Yeah, you didn't live there. So Adam Vaughn, his father was a major media commentator at City TV in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So, or let's say 70s and 80s. So in the 80s, Adam, he got intrigued by our information, Bob Marshall's show, which was called The International Connection. So he came down to meet Bob Marshall. He didn't know about me. And then he became station manager because he had a bit of clout through his father. So the students at Ryerson wanted to, you know, be connected to him. So they made him station manager really fast in 85. And then he wanted to be connected to Bob Marshall. So he did a Saturday show with Bob Marshall and Nelson. And in 87, we were going to do, I got him interested into McLuhan because McLuhan, his father and he grew up on the edge of Wedgwood Park. So McLuhan was a friend of Colin Vaughn, his father. So Adam, as a kid, grew up with McLuhan in his house. He didn't have much of an understanding of him, but by the time he's at CKLN, and Nelson and Bob Marshall talk about McLuhan, and I might be around. And so he eventually asked Nelson to present the McLuhan Archives, and they'd make a special series. And they started it in 86, and Adam got mad at Dave Neufeld, who later went on to make Bob's Media Ecology, those two albums for Nelson. Dave was the news director, and Adam got pissed off at him and fired him a week before the volts, the watts or whatever were going to go up. And it was going to be a larger audience. It would be further broadcast further out of Ryerson and across the city. And
was the station owned by Ryerson?
Yeah, it was a station for the students to use and learn. But some of these students took it over, and when they graduated, they stayed there. And they started making little mini careers at CKLN, and the students really weren't interested in it or didn't use it much. So it became a clique. And some of those guys, they would do that to get attention, and then they'd get hired at CBC.
Sure.
And Ralph Ben-Murgi and Anton Leo and John Jones came out of that scene. That's when we were there in 84, 85, 86, when we first were there. And remember, Ralph Ben-Murgi had a Peter Zosky show on Saturday, on Friday night or something. Do you remember that? He had
no.
It didn't do well. Didn't last long. But anyways, these characters were around Adam Vaughn. So they got mad at Bob Marshall and fired him in May 87. No, they fired Dave Neufeld in July 86. And he'd been working for 2 years. He was a student at Ryerson. But then he'd graduated, and he spent a lot of time being the news director. And he put a lot of effort into building it up, the news department, for the big increased broadcasting range. And they fired him the week before the big increase of wattage, or I guess you call it, watts. And they put this jerk in, Martin Stott, I think. He was just a guy who'd been hanging around for a month or two. And they made him news director, and he lasted about 3 weeks. He was so bad. And then, okay, that's 86. Because Bob Marshall was a friend of Dave Neufeld, Adam was suspicious of, when they stopped doing the Saturday show, he was suspicious of Bob Marshall. And so in May 87, he was resigning in June 87, and in May 87, he fired Bob Marshall, and that was the end of that. And then Mike Dyer, who was a popular DJ on the station and wasn't a student, he never came out of Ryerson. By that time, people would just come in from the world and get a gig, play music or something, or some specialized music. And so Mike Dyer asked Bob Marshall if he could play May Brussel tapes. Bob Marshall would just do 10-minute summaries of the weekly tapes, but the tapes were an hour long. So Friday night, Mike Dyer made Mae Brussel famous in Toronto by playing the whole hour-long broadcast, and they were really amazing broadcasts. And
didn't Dyer have something to do with McLuhan?
No, nothing at all. He had no interest. No, Mike was more in the music world. He promoted couple of jazz concerts and things, and he became a sound man, studio man for the TV show about kids, Degrassi High. Did you ever hear of that show?
No.
He got involved with TV. His wife went on, later his wife went on to be a DJ on CBC when it became two things, you know, CBC One, CBC Two. Remember that? No, you probably didn't. And anyway, she was a world music person. So they were in the media of Toronto. So he played Mae Brussel, and that was fantastic. And he still didn't know me hardly at all. So I went to the meeting in June 87 when Adam introduced the new station manager, which was a lesbian from British Guiana, I think. A lefty, and involved with the NDP, I think. So he introduced her, and that was the end of Adam. He went off to City TV, and Mike Dyer approaches me after the meeting, because I wanted to see what was happening at the station, because I still wanted to do stuff on the station, but my in, Bob Marshall, was gone. So I was trying to figure out, how do I get on the radio myself, is what I was thinking. But out of the blue, Mike Dyer, and I would say it was only vague in my mind because I didn't know if I could get connected. But anyways, Mike Dyer comes up to me and he says, "Have you ever heard of the Church of the Subgenius?" And I said, "Yeah, I inspired that." He says, "What?" And I told him it was based on my father and all that stuff. And I don't know if you know the story, but I'm not going to go into it too much. So he said, "Well, I'm playing their tapes, their own radio tapes out of Dallas, and on my weekly show, could you come on and talk about what you're telling me?" And I said, "Sure." So I went on in June, might have been like June 17th, 1987, and it was amazing what I said. The first question was, What are you? Who are you? And I said, I was here before the Logos, and I'll be here after the Logos. How's that for an opening statement? That's pretty good, eh?
Well, sounds like you.
Yeah. Well, I became later. Yeah, that was me, but nobody knew that was me. So I should send you the link. You should listen to my first interview. It's pretty incredible what I say. And he was shocked by all this. And so he invited me back 2 weeks later. And then management kind of liked it. I remember we were coming up to something called the Harmonic Convergence in August. You ever hear of that? The Harmonic Convergence?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a New Age thing. And I went on there in a harmonic conversion. I call it harmonic Bob Virgins. And I talked about Elvis Presley and all this crazy stuff. And the management came down and were looking through the studio window and laughing, and they liked me. So I just continued every 2 weeks, and we didn't know how long it would go. And it ended up being for 4 years. And everybody eventually thought it was my show, and then magazine articles were written. So
was the 4 years were the same show?
Yeah, it was always Mike Dyer. He was the host, and he would do his own kind of music one Wednesday night, and I'd come down the second Wednesday night. Then he'd do his on the next. So I'd be on twice a month. And that went for 4 years, where he moved out of the city and got a farm kind of situation. He left the TV show. And so he couldn't come back into the city and do the show as much. It was too far away. So what happened is there was another guy in the station who I'd become friends with. So he had a show on a Thursday. Mike was Wednesday, midnight till 2 in the morning. And we would take calls. And no one else really did that on the air. And so then Wayne Morris... I asked him, I said, I've got about 4 more shows I need to do. What I was going to do was play a lot of my interactions with the Evergreens channeled by Michael Blake Reed and play my conversations with, that's 91, yes, with McLuhan and Frank Zappa. No, not Zappa, he wasn't dead yet, but Mae Brussel, she was dead. A lot of people I was interviewing through the astroplane. And I played a few on with Mike in 89, 90, but not that many. But I decided I wanted to go out with a bang, so Wayne said he'd let me on for 4 more shows once a month. So I did April, May, June, July, August. I did 5 shows. You can hear my archives. And I played a lot of channeled material. And then that was it. And so... So I'm getting into the fall of 91, and Carolyn is now doing Mir, and we're getting ready to go to New York City at some point in 92 or 93. And so I took the time to create the book Fatic Communion, which was supposed to be a souvenir from A Ritual in Progress, quotes from LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, or William Irwin Thompson, Arthur Croker, and stuff from my own show, which were provided by Dave Neufeld, because by that time he's making the album, started in 1990, Bosmic Ecology, and Nelson gave me tapes of my show, and Dave, to get a handle on it, he would have to transcribe them all. So I took his transcriptions of my shows that Nelson had given him, and I put that in the book as my part of the book. So Fatic Communion with Bob Dobbs was created while waiting for us to go to New York, and I put together this book for people who were interested in what I had created on CKLN, so I stuck it in a few bookstores, you know. It was self-published. And so that's where that...
You gave me a copy in New York.
In 98, with Mark.
Yeah.
Ah, okay, good. Yeah, I had them back then. I haven't got many left now, but... normally I just send out a digital, you know, version of it. It's all the contents. But I wonder, do you have it there? What did I write? I used to write a sort of a special message to whoever I gave it to. I don't know what, I didn't really know you, so I don't know what if I, I don't know if I wrote anything. Do you remember? Do you have it there?
No, I don't. And I don't even know where the copy is at the moment. I have to look for it.
Okay. Yeah, maybe if you come across it, let's see if I wrote something to you. But the, okay, so
I didn't understand what I was talking about, so I doubt that you did.
Yeah, I wouldn't know how to I would categorize people, you know. You'd have, you'd stand out in some way. But I didn't know anything about you, so I probably couldn't have. And I didn't, and it's sort
you
of
didn't
personal.
Get the chemistry stuff.
Yeah, no, I didn't know what the hell you were talking about. But the, but the, I would give it to friends, and there'd be a certain relationship or aspect to it, and I'd highlight it. But we weren't friends. I didn't know anything about you, and just had you that one day at Mark's. And you were a stranger, though I knew George Sanderson, and I knew about your project, what you were going to do, and digitize stuff. That's what I learned when you were there that day. But we're talking about me going to McLuhan Seminars. That's where this came from. And I stopped going to McLuhan Seminars in 84 when we got on CKLN. That Derek was running. And I never went back until the late 90s, I think. I was staying at Michael Edmonds, and for some reason, Derek had some special guests from the Philippines or something. They'd won some award that somebody around the McLuhan Center was giving out. So we went to the seminar with this female journalist. I think she was female, and that's where I talked to Derek for the first time in 15 years or something. But what I did once, I used to have private sessions with Michael Blake Reed nearby Church Street, which was nearby McLuhan's coach house. Church Street would go up to Bloor. And so in that hotel, Michael would set up for a couple weeks and do private sessions. So he'd make an appointment, go there, and it would be recorded. So one time in 99 or so, I had just talked to McLuhan for a good stretch of stuff. And so I'm walking back to Michael Edmonds, and I'm walking near the coach house, and I notice it's after hours, but it's open. So I go in the side door, and there are students with high-tech stuff. Derek emphasized technology more, in his, it seemed to me, in a scene at the college, at the coach house. So I walked in, and there were these you know, smart-looking 20 or 2-year-olds sitting there, and I might have said, I was the archivist of Marshall McLuhan. So I'm a ghost that just shows up on the side door. And I held up the two cassettes and I said, I just talked to Marsha McLuhan. It's all on these recordings. And then they looked at me, puzzled, didn't really say anything, so I turned around and left. So that was my little invasion of Derek's scene. And the stupid students, they should have run out. What? You talked to me? If it was me, I'd say, what'd you say? You talked to McLuhan? What are you talking about? I would have taken an interest. But they're so distracted by the digital technology, you know, they're beginning to become the stupid people we witness today, the stupid generations who are digitized and super angels and don't know it. You know what I mean? They're gone. They disappeared. You follow
me?
Well,
I don't know that it just happened since the 80s, let's say.
You don't know what happened.
This numb.
Just a minute, I'm checking.
Yeah,
hello.
Speedy. Yeah, it's still working. I think we're still recording. Okay. We're okay. Okay.
Well,
now, what were you saying about the 80s?
It's the same as last week.
I got into gossip. We have to be careful. Tech Body gets pissed off. He'll disconnect if I get into these stories too much. So what did you say about the 80s?
I'm saying, well, you were saying that the kids became super angels and basically
got
numb.
Yeah, this is in 99, once the Internet started.
Yeah, but the numb,
goes way, way back.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The history of it, I don't really know, but it would be interesting to try to figure out. But people got numbed when they had to leave the land, right? Most people were living on farms, even in North America,
yeah,
in 1900. And then by 1930, there were more people in the cities than on the farms. And by 1950, most people by far lived in cities of one sort or another. And in that process, people got stupid.
Yeah, they got discarnate and went on welfare.
I don't know that welfare.
No, that's the 30s. And money, as McLuhan said, became public property.
Uh-huh.
And you had to have, nobody had access to land anymore, so they needed to be fed, so they had to have money. A basic subsistence thing. That comes in the 30s. Important point he makes.
Well,
money becomes public property. In North America, anyways. And he said that in a early 70s interview for St. Michael's student paper. It's a good interview. But anyway,
well, that was that theory, you could say, was social credit. And,
yeah.
Social credit in Western Canada was a very powerful force.
I know the greatest Canadian, Tommy Douglas.
No, that's the socialist. That's CCF.
Oh, wasn't that social credit at some point?
No, no. Social credit was Eberhard in Alberta and Bennett in BC. And they basically, the remnants of the Social Credit Party ran Alberta and BC up until, I don't know if it was the 60s or the 70s when they finally lost power.
Mm.
But for decades, social credit was the great power in both BC and Alberta.
And Tommy Douglas was the great power in Saskatchewan with the
Correct.
CCP, which became the NDP, right?
Right, CCF.
CCF, right.
Yeah.
Became.
So, yeah. Yeah, and he, we lived just down the street from Tommy Douglas, and his daughter went to the same elementary school as I did. She was older than I was, but people still talked about, you know, sort of what a beautiful girl she was. She was everybody's idol.
Mm. Now, you said you went to school with her in elementary?
No, no, no. I went to the same school. But about, she was maybe 5 or 6 years ahead of me.
Right.
So I was never at the school at the same time as her.
But your neighbor was Tommy Douglas.
Yeah, they lived down, well, not exactly the neighbor, but we lived on the same street about a block apart.
Right. And this would be a kind of a semi-suburb?
No, no. This is close to downtown Regina. You
like McLuhan, in
yeah, a little bit
in Winnipeg. Yeah, they weren't that big, these places.
Right. They in those years, the whole idea of suburbs was more or less foreign to Canada.
Mm.
It had started in Southern California.
Yeah.
But in those years, people started the first suburbs, and it was a big deal.
In California or in Canada?
Well, it started in California and then it got copied in Canada.
By the 60s, say?
Yeah, it started in the late 60s, I would say.
Yeah. So, Tommy Douglas, for the listeners, Canada ran a poll maybe around 2000 about who was the greatest Canadian. And Tommy Douglas, not that anybody remembered him much, but for some reason he got voted the greatest Canadian, right?
Yeah. Well, because of the Canadian medical plan.
Right, that, socialized medicine.
Right. And everybody, that's now, I would say, probably the most popular thing about Canada, especially compared to the United States. I must say that it's a system that works very well in some respects, but in other respects is very, very bureaucratic.
I know all about it from Carolyn. You know, she worked in the system in Toronto for many years. So Tommy Douglas, the archetype of Canada is socialized medicine, so he's the guy who's given credit for starting it in Saskatchewan. Right.
Yeah, and he's also liked because he was a fighter. He was actually a boxer.
Oh, yeah? He seemed to be a skinny guy. I remember him being skinny.
That's right, but he was a boxer. I believe he was born in Scotland, emigrated to Canada, and I believe went to school in Canada, in Brandon, I think, and then worked his way up, and he was always fighting against powers that nobody thought you could do anything about.
He was like a David against Goliath.
Correct, correct. And eventually became the premier of Saskatchewan and started a medical program in Saskatchewan that was very unpopular with doctors. My dad was a doctor, and a great number of doctors in Saskatchewan left when the program was instituted, including my father.
And that's in 62? In my mind, it's like the early 60s, right?
I would say it's a little bit later, but you're right in the rough time period.
Yeah, in the 60s.
My memory is that my dad moved from Regina to Calgary. I was already in university, so I wasn't involved in all of this. I was thousands of miles away. But it seems to me that they moved maybe in 64, maybe in 63 even.
Yeah.
And so 62 may well have been the year that it was first instituted.
Yeah. You said Brandon. Is that Brandon, Manitoba?
Yes.
That's where he grew up. Okay.
No, well, I wouldn't say that. He grew up in Scotland. But Brandon was a Baptist college affiliated with McMaster and with Acadia in Wolfville.
Okay, Wolfville, Nova Scotia.
That's right.
Yeah.
And these Baptist colleges were very influential in Canadian history. People don't know much about them. But they gave birth to a lot of independent thinkers, gave birth to a lot of political figures, usually on the left. And Tom Easterbrook, McLuhan's great buddy, before he taught at University of Toronto, taught at Brandon. And so there's lots of connections with not only Canadian history in general, but with McLuhan in particular.
Right. So he grows up in Scotland, comes over, and he ends up in Brandon, Manitoba.
I believe.
Tommy Douglas.
I'm not 100% sure about that, but I believe that's where he went to college and then goes from Brandon to Weyburn in Saskatchewan, which isn't that far from Brandon, and eventually became the MLA from Weyburn, became the head of the CCF in Saskatchewan, and then became the premier.
Right. Okay, so did McLuhan ever comment on Tommy Douglas? You know,
don't know. Don't know. I'm sure he commented in places on the CCF, and it would take some looking. McLuhan actually talked a lot about Canadian history in ways that aren't appreciated because nobody's bothered to do the research.
Right.
But you could go into his writings and his interviews, and you would get an interesting overview of Canadian history in the 20th century.
Right, and he did the Canadian character in different provinces or areas in Counterblast in 54.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he did commentary on Canadian artists,
yep.
And on Canadian music, Canadian poetry he wrote an essay on. So all of these things are like little islands that are separated in a far-off archipelago.
Yeah.
But they could be put together at some point.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
So, okay, so we finished the interview with the tech body. Now we'll go back to the beginning and work our way through, and I'll show how it leads into the creation of the tech body, well, how McLuhan was anticipating it.
Uh-huh. Sure.
What do you think of that?
Definitely we'll do that. And at some point, I think what you have to do is talk about Trump. Because, I mean, that's in the title of the brochure. But more than that, when we've been talking about Trump, it's obvious that there are many different aspects of the man and of his presidency and of his election loss and all this sort of stuff, which are complicated. So what you didn't know about Trump initially must seem to people as, number one, something that's positive about Trump and something that's not very ambiguous.
Yeah.
But the conversations we've had concerning the book, I can see that that's not at all the picture that you're trying to give. And so then it would be it'll be interesting to hear more about just how Trump is figured here. There's many voices and faces of Trump that you're trying to point up.
Yeah, now people, they could say 6 months ago, Bob fucked up. He wrote about Trump, thought he was significant, thought he'd win again, and he's a nobody. But no, Trump is back, and it's a very complicated scene right now. And Trump's just saying he's fucking president, for fuck's sake. This is nuts in American history to be talking the way he is. But you watch as the court cases go through. It ain't over. So,
but it's also true, Bob, that this man had very great power as the president, and a significant number of the problems that he encountered and that he's had subsequent to his presidency, he could have done something about, but he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know enough about the levers of power to actually exercise power and to retain power.
Right. Well, we'll see. Yeah. I have other things. It's more complicated than that.
But at any rate, we agree that complications are very important to this.
Yeah, he is a phenomenon. He represents, he's a figure for our time. Like, you run through the figures that McLuhan liked. Florence Nightingale for the Telegraph. Charlie Chaplin for the movie. Hitler for the radio. Beatles, Red Sullivan for TV, or Walter Cronkite. What did he say about who was the figure for TV?
Well, I mean, the people you just mentioned.
Cronkite, Beatles, and Ed Sullivan. He talked about them.
Yeah.
And Jack Parr.
Yeah, absolutely. Jack Parr, for sure.
And then that's it. There's nobody. He can't, you know, satellite, computer, don't think he has anthropomorphic images for them, right? For those environments.
Not that come immediately to mind.
Right.
It's more collectivities like IBM and General Electric.
Right. So Trump is the Florence Nightingale, so to speak, of social media.
Yeah,
I mean, not like her, but an icon. If McLuhan was around, he could point out the meaning of McLuhan. of Trump, and he's a significant rupture of something. Yep. So.
Yeah. So even, I mean, even the distinction between the man and the icon is a complication.
No, there's a lot of fun stuff to talk about. That will, McLuhan is one of the best guides to it.
Maybe. I have to close soon, but one thing I want to mention that we can discuss at another time is in the last quotation of the book, there's the word syndicate.
Yes.
Of course, what the hell a syndicate is a very interesting question.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I try to do with you is I try to think sort of what you are able to echo in your distinctive way. So you used to talk all the time about solar government and all of this.
Yeah.
And there is a humorous side to that.
Yeah.
But there's also a very serious side to that.
Yep.
And so here's McLuhan talking about the syndicate in 1972, and you're talking about solar governments and.
Well, his solar government statement is in 71 in the Varsity Graduate, the hijacking of cities, nations, and planets.
Yeah. So, and this kind of hijacking, which we've talked about in the past, is very, very important.
Yep.
I mean, that's exactly what is dominating history at the moment.
Yes.
Everything has been hijacked.
Right, that's the meaning of Rumpelstiltskin in the bottom corner of my tiny note chart.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
He's the hijacker. And we can't name him. We can't figure out what his name is, you know, how to describe him. And I'm attempting to do that.
Correct. So all of that is very interesting stuff.
Yeah. It'll be fun to talk about.
And we'll get into that. All of those topics, all of those related topics in future conversations.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, well, that was very good. It's still echoing in the background, so I think we got it all on record tonight.
Maybe.
That's good.
Maybe. We'll see.
All right. Okay.
Okay, Bob.
Have a good week. All right,
thanks.
Bye.
You too. Bye.